We needed coffee, but we got ourselves convinced that the later we left it, the better it would taste. And as the country grew flatter and the roads became quiet and dusk began to colour the sky, you could guess from the way we retuned the radio and unfolded the map or commented on the view that the tang of determination had overtaken our thoughts. And when, fidgety and untalkative, but almost home, we drew up outside the all-night restaurant, it felt like we might just stay in the car, listening to the engine and the gentle sound of the wind.
Matthew Elton was born in Nottingham, lives in Manchester, and has published two poetry collections with Carcanet. His first collection, The Book of Matthew, 2003, was a Guardian Book of the Year and won the Durwood Aldeburgh First Collection Prize. He was a Hawthornden Fellow in 2004 and was awarded a Durwood Upper Writing Fellowship in 2008. He lectures in creative writing at the University of Bolton. First of all, could you talk about what made you decide on your unusual 101-word title?
One reason I came up with this 101-word title was, if you follow my logic, that I really didn't want it to have a 101-word title. Basically, when I published my first book, I had a couple of very lengthy editorial sessions at Carcanet with Michael, and we went through like the manuscript in great detail, and there were things that he didn't like that he'd asked me to change, and if I could sort of justify what they were doing there, then he would keep them there, and if my explanation wasn't good enough for him, then I'd end up sort of changing it or dropping it from the book. But there were a number of things that were kind of like negotiating chips, and so we did a bit of deal making as we went along. And what I figured would happen was there would be absolutely no way that Michael would like a 101-word title. So I figured if I put one in there, then it would be a hostage to fortune so that I could use it in the horse trading process. So when he said, you're going to have to lose that title, I could make it like I was really sad to be losing something. And I'd say, well, if I'm going to lose that, then you've got to agree to X, Y or Z. And I was really expecting Michael to say, you can't have 101-word title, I was going to say, oh, I'm really, really sorry to lose it. And then just to, you know, use it as a bargaining counter. But I gave it to Michael and he said, brilliant, a colophonic title. Just like in the old days, 200 years ago, when people used to have titles that were actually descriptions of the contents of the book and took an entire page to take up. So he called my bluff and cornered me, really.
Your first collection, The Book of Matthew, was described as playful, witty, and irresistibly memorable. And the title poem borrows its structure from Roget's Thesaurus to spin 39 variations on sounds, images, and rhythms. Your new collection is described as audacious, mischievous, even outrageous. Can you talk about how your work has developed since your first publication?
When I was writing my first book, I think I was trying to test myself or prove something to myself, and there were all kinds of things that I was obviously learning to do as I went along. I'm always trying to do things I've not seen before, but also I think first time around I was trying to do a lot of things that were kind of challenges to myself. So, you know, never writing in the first person, or trying to write, say, using iambic rhythms that didn't sound like they were thudding like a man with a wooden leg or something. And this time I wanted to do some looser things. And often the challenges came about from working with other people. So, for example, the sequence four-letter words, all the words in that poem are made up of four letters. But that began as a musical collaboration. It was a song cycle that I wrote with Larry Goves. We came upon that as a collaborative idea from sort of sitting down, drinking coffee for a very long day. We said, if we're going to work together, then it's going to be this and it's going to be this. You know, like in those films, when you've got war films where you've got like generals who are sort of pushing things around a map of Europe, we would be like setting up all these imperatives and so on. I'm going to do this and you're going to do this, trying to outmaneuver each other, or trying to collaboratively outmaneuver each other, if there's such a thing. And so he was using all these chord clusters that had some resemblance to four-letter words, except musically. That's something I wouldn't have arrived at if I'd just done it on my own. I mean, I'm very interested in those kind of imperatives and those kind of strategic approaches, but I reckon there's no way I would have come up with that particular one. Similarly, something like the Japan and South Korea 2002, which is based on the structure of the World Cup from that year, was something I did with a painter called Claire Bleakley, who was obsessed with football and football stadiums. So that poem ended up having one sentence written per match of the World Cup tournament. And, you know, that was kind of following her imperatives, and there was something somewhere in there that involved using a dictionary in quite a systematic way. Those were my responses to challenges set by other people, and it was really nice to be doing something without thinking, I'm going to write this and try and put it in Poetry Review or Stand or PNR or any of those places. It was all to do with there being a different audience for words that wasn't necessarily reading the poetry magazines. The first time I wrote a book, I spent a lot of time looking at what was in other people's books, and there was always that acknowledgements page saying these poems appeared in, and it would list like 20 poetry magazines or something. And I think, to an extent, I wanted to do that first time around, and then second time around, I thought, well, God, I'm not interested in that anymore.
So your second book contains several of your collaborations with artists working in different artistic mediums, music and visual art, for example. When you came to include these pieces in your new book, was there a sense of having to alter or refit them to make them work as poems on the page? Or did you want to keep the integrity of the collaborations by leaving them unchanged?
That's a great question, but no, not at all. It was not so much the integrity of the original in terms of it being a record of the collaboration, but even if I was writing something that wasn't intended to be a poem in the first place, it was meant to be like textual art or song lyric or something, I try and make it watertight. I try sort of not to let it fray. And so I felt that they, to extend the metaphor, did hold water, could work in a different context, I hope. You know, I'm not specifically writing to cater to different audiences, but I'm aware when I write something that, one, I need to be doing something with the vocabulary, and I also need to be doing something with the sentence structure, and I also need to be doing something with the rhythm within the line and the rhythms between the lines and the rhythms between the stanzas. You know, there's all kinds of things that are going on in when you put words together that are inescapable. So there's got to be an extent that you're aware of the word histories, whether that's like pure etymology or if that's what you're alluding to, other things that other people have written. But I think language is at best a kind of best fit approximation of what goes on in life. I don't think it ever precisely matches what goes on in life. It's like having a picture that's quite crudely pixelated, and obviously you try and make it look as smooth and untechnical as possible, which is the game. The technical side is, you know, it's inescapable, while at the same time not looking like I'm doing it too studiously. Wearing it lightly, if you can.
So you've mentioned language and word history as playing a part in your poetry. Are there other influences, such as writers or artists, that have informed your work?
Yeah, a changing raft of influences every time. There are certainly times when I'm trying to imitate, you know, for example, in writing four-letter words, that was written as a set of songs, and there's a big section in that with made-up words, with words where we began with sort of, I think it was about 20 of the most common four-letter swear words that we could think of, and we sort of made anagrams of all those swear words, so to speak. That was certainly influenced by some of the songs that the composer Ligeti wrote, where he's using convoluted language because that is the only thing that's equal to the music that he's trying to write. I just thought it'd be very interesting to try and make a language that was purely there for the music of a specific song. I think it does a job. I think, you know, it doesn't make denotative sense, but maybe that's not what it's about anyway. For some of the schematic things, I was certainly paying heed to some of the writers from the Ulipo group, like Raymond Cano or Harry Matthews, perhaps. Although I think with a lot of those writers, they're more successful at concealing their seams, whereas I think it's often quite clear if there's a kind of imperative going on that's dictated something I've written. Who else? Raymond Roussel is fascinating, isn't he? My other long-term collaborator is an artist stroke curator called Chris Evans. He works a lot in Sculpture Park. He was doing this project, he's doing this book called Magnetic Promenade and Other Sculpture Parks, and he asked me to write something for it, and said as a starting point, why don't you look at Locus Solus, the Roussel book, which is a novel from about 100 years ago, which is basically, it's about a guided tour around the sculpture park. And I've only read it in the translation. My French isn't up to reading novels by Roussel. But I've only read it in the translation, which doesn't translate the ploy which is used, which is, apparently, he's got this kind of loosely homophonic, tightly homophonic, perhaps, thing going on from every sentence, so that in each sentence there'll be a word which rhymes with a word in the next sentence, which, and something in that sentence which rhymes with a word in the next sentence. And by that way, there's a kind of method of procedure. So I read the book, and I also read, there's that book that Roussel also wrote called How I Wrote Certain of My Books, which is out from Exact Change. And that's where Roussel describes that method, which I guess I needed to read, because it's not clear from reading the English translation in the John Calder edition. The poem that I wrote for that was called I Must Say That At First It Was Difficult Work, and I twisted the imperative a little bit, and I wrote 36 sentences which roughly rhymed with I must say that at first it was difficult work. So, off the top of my head, the Messiah was the worst for discussing the waitresses. The Mercedes is hers, but she drives in reverse. The music station in Amherst was affected the worst. The rehearsals resumed with indifferent music. But that kind of idea. Who else was I interested in? I think when It by Inger Christensen came out a few years ago in the English translation for the first time, that really spoke to me, because that was like a poet who could do incredibly formal things, very much of her own devising, but yet which were certainly not stilted, certainly not stunted by the imperative. I think there's something really interesting, because the cliche is that you know, it's meant to be male writers who do all the kind of formal, procedural, structurally tight stuff, and female writers who leap from the soul as such. And I think, you know, as a generalisation, it's absolutely pure evil. And as I've already said, I think, however you're looking at language, it doesn't work like that. And a great counter to that is someone like Inger Christensen, who writes these erudite, beautiful, smart, emotional, intelligent, formal, I don't know, late modernist poetry.
Your new collection is a Poetry Book Society recommendation for autumn 2009. How do you feel about it?
It's really nice that it should come even before the book came out. I think when my first book came out, that the buzz was like after it came out, because like the reviews started coming in, and that was all very new to me. This time, I think I was aware at some point that reviews would start to happen and people would react to the book. I was really not expecting there to be a reaction like 2 or 3 months before it came out. So when I heard that the Poetry Book Society had chosen it for one of their autumn recommendations, it felt like a very good start to the life of the book.
In 2008, you were awarded a Gurwood Opera Writing Fellowship with the composer Larry Goves, who you've worked with on numerous collaborative projects. In what direction is this project taking your writing?
It's another chapter in this collaborative thing. If this book marks my kind of acknowledging that one thing I always wanted to do in creative endeavours, I think my priority wasn't just to write poems for the rest of my life, but it was to find the tools through which I could meet people and find things to work on. I was never very good with a paintbrush or a camera or as a musician or any of those kind of things, but I didn't think that was any reason why I shouldn't, as a writer, get into areas where it was more natural to collaborate. The common view of the writer is that they're a solipsist or an autocrat or something, and you go off to your garret or wherever it is until the book comes out. So having collaborated with Larry Goves on 3 or 4 things of different kinds, like spoken word things and song cycles, things that have been written for me to perform with his ensemble, the House of Bedlam, things that have been written for other groups like Sappho, things that have been written for orchestras and chamber ensembles. He was always keen to do an opera, and I was like, you'll never get me up in one of those. And he kept asking, and I kept saying no, until eventually he had this idea that we should do something loosely drawing on poetry of Frank O'Hara, but not using Frank O'Hara's poems, but using sort of kind of imitations, and presenting something certainly not overbiographical. You know, we think of O'Hara as someone who tells his life through his poems. Obviously there's more to it than that, and there's a certain angle, there's some spin when you write what you've been doing between 1 and 2 in the afternoon and put it into a poem. We were very interested in, you know, that film 32 Films about Glenn Gould, which is has got some active scenes which are kind of based on Glenn Gould's life, but also it's got recordings of his music and interviews with people who played with him, and some animations and some kind of things that are more or less like pop videos. And we thought if we could do something drawing on O'Hara that wasn't really a narrative, but that sort of painted him as a curator at the Museum of Modern Art, and as a member of the New York School, and as, you know, the author of poems like all those I Do This, I Do That things that begin in lunch poems, then there'd be some fun to be had. So I'm spending most of this year wrecking my head trying to do that, and it's proven to be really hard to do. It's a more extended, more multi-dimensional project than anything I've ever done before. But it's heading in the right direction. It's taken me about 3 or 4 months of solidly working on it to find how to like it, because I think I began by doing the first section and threw myself into that and then didn't know where to go. And I've worked out that, as with like a shorter poem that I might write, I can do a bit here and a bit there and get the bearing of the whole as I progress, rather than doing it in a more linear fashion. We're writing it for Oldbury Music, part of something called Jerwood Opera Writing Fellowship. Got 5 fellowships running all at once. They also now, I suppose, that there are as many ways of writing an opera as there are operas, you know. Notionally, you've got 24 months to do it in, but once we deliver a bit to them, then they're going to give us a workshop. It means they've got to get a pile of conductors, directors, set designers, musicians, singers in the same room. And perhaps they're quite enjoying not having that headache just yet.
Matthew Welton's new collection, We Needed Coffee, But, priced £9.95, is available from the Carcanet website, Amazon and all major bookshops. His poem Springtime, set by musical composer Larry Goves, is now available on CD from London Sinfonietta's Jerwood series, available from London Sinfonietta's website.